We're exploring a piece of U.S. Civil War history this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the spring of 1862, more than 1,200 Confederate prisoners of war were taken to Madison and held at Camp Randall. That was the Union troops' training grounds, named after Wisconsin Governor Alexander Randall. About 140 Confederate prisoners died in captivity from disease and war wounds. Their grave markers at Confederate Rest are a source of tension to this day. How do you think we should mark the graves of Confederate soldiers in Wisconsin? What would it take for our nation to heal from the damage of slavery and the war that was fought to end it? We're at 800-642-1234. Larry Desautels is the author of the book, The Captured, the Sick, and the Dead, Confederate Soldiers at Camp Randall. He taught history and political science for 32 years at Arrowhead High School in Heartland. Larry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So when you set out to work on this book, what did you want to learn about these men, these soldiers?
Well, I guess I got to start with everything because I didn't know anything. I happened to come upon that cemetery and then I read a little bit about it and I went and looked at it the first time. It was in winter and, you know, kind of like not on like a day like today. And it was so stark. And so I wanted to learn something about these guys who were there, these men who, you know, ended up dying so far away from home and to see who they were. You know, actually look them up, try to find out personal information about them. That's what got me interested in it, that Alabama guys would be, among others, would be here in Wisconsin. That would be their final resting place.
Where did the Confederate soldiers who were held at Camp Randall, where did they come from?
The most of them came from Alabama. There was the first Alabama regiment, what was called the 1st Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi Regiment. Those two were the source of most of the soldiers, but there was also a big contingent from the 55th Tennessee, and then just a few from Louisiana, Arkansas, and Kentucky.
Take us to the battle where these men were captured.
That was at a place called Madrid Bend, which is an area of the Mississippi that there's a double loop there. You can kind of form a triangle between New Madrid, Missouri, Tiptonville, Tennessee, and Island Number 10, which is in the middle of Madrid Bend. And it's called Island Number 10. Because it was at that time the 10th island between where the Ohio empties into the Mississippi, south of that, I should say.
This particular battle gets overshadowed by other major Civil War battles. Why is that? What was unique about this battle?
What was unique about the battle was that it was basically a siege operation. And the fact that the day before, this was the second day of Shiloh. And Shiloh, of course, was one of the bloodiest days in the Civil War. And so people got lost. There was not a great number or a great loss of life in Island Number 10. Basically, many of the Confederate soldiers had already evacuated to go down to fight at Shiloh. What was left basically was some artillerists of these regiments that I described before, and then a great number of sick people that were not evacuated, were considered to be too sick to be transported south on the Mississippi. I guess it also made a household name of a guy named General John Pope. Pope ended up becoming the head of Union forces as a result of his victory there, although he was eventually basically shipped west after failure in campaigns in 1863. So I think those things make it unique. I know Mark Twain once said, you know, that the island is like the battle itself. It kind of got washed away in history.
Mm, Wow. We're talking with Larry Desautels, who is the author of The Captured, the Sick, and the Dead, Confederate Soldiers at Camp Randall. You can join in. How do you think we should mark the graves of Confederate soldiers? Is there a respectful way to acknowledge Confederate soldiers who died? What would it take for our country to heal from the damage of slavery and the war that was fought to end it? Join in with your connection, your observations of the Civil War, 800-642-1234. Larry, take us inside Camp Randall in Madison. Now we know it as a major stadium for Badgers football, but this was the primary training camp for Union soldiers. What was it like?
Well, they had, in order to house the prisoners, they had to build some special barracks, or at least transform them into barracks. They kind of rebuilt a hospital, put a new floor. There wasn't really any other regiment there at the time. The 19th, which was the 19th Wisconsin, I should say, which formed the guards at Camp Randall, they were kind of a different regiment because they're the only one that was actually formed under the authority of the War Department rather than under the authority of the governor and the state of Wisconsin. They had been training at Camp Utley in Racine, and because they were in Wisconsin, they were brought up to take care of these prisoners. They had no training whatsoever in, you know, being guards. They really had no training in even in the use of firearms yet. But Camp Randall then had already mustered out upwards of 15 different regiments, some of which are the most famous in Wisconsin history, you know, the 2nd and the 6th and the 7th that formed the Iron Brigade, and already the 15th Wisconsin, the Scandinavian Brigade of Hans Haig, was very, very, very important in our history. In fact, they were at Island Number 10. They were the ones that actually captured the prisoners that were held at Island Number 10. Go ahead.
There was some trepidation to make Camp Randall a place to house these prisoners of war. What were the hesitations of doing this?
Well, the Commissioner General of Prisons for the Union was a guy named William Hoffman. And William Hoffman very much stood on his prerogative that he decided where prisoners would go. You have to remember, this is relatively early in the war. It's you know, the war had been going on for a year. Up to this point, a lot of prisoners simply were paroled immediately upon capture. That is, they were basically sent back to their own army, and then when they then at some point they would actually be officially released. But he did not want Madison to be a prison site. He wanted all the prisoners basically to be sent to Camp Butler in Springfield, Illinois, and then also Camp Douglas, the one in Chicago, not the Camp Douglas that we know here in Wisconsin, and also in Indiana. That's where he wanted them to go. But General Henry Halleck, who is the head of the Department of the West, basically made a decision, and he outranked Hoffman, that some prisoners were going to be sent to Camp Randall. And that's how the 1,200 of them, some of which were actually, non-soldiers, some of them were non-combatants, ended up in Madison.
We're talking with author Larry Desautels. His new book explores the lives of the Confederate soldiers who were imprisoned in Wisconsin during the Civil War. Did your ancestors fight in the Civil War? What do you want to know about their lives? Do you have artifacts passed down? What should our country do about memorials and statues to Confederate leaders and Confederate burials? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with historian Larry Desautels here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're learning about the lives of Confederate soldiers who were held at Camp Randall in the Civil War. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Today, Camp Randall is home to tens of thousands of Badger football fans in non-pandemic times, mind you. In the Civil War, it was the primary training ground for Wisconsin's volunteer infantrymen. It took in more than 1,200 Confederate soldiers who were captured in the spring of 1862. What questions do you have about the role of Camp Randall? Have you studied the Civil War? What draws you to understanding these battles and the deep divides in our society trying to reckon with slavery? It's 800-642-1234. Larry Desautels' book is called The Captured, the Sick, and the Dead, and he stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in Tim now, joining us from Heartland. Hi, Tim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I have a question for Larry. Larry, your book is very well written, and I really enjoyed reading it. You're a very good good writer, but I'm wondering at the end of your book, you talk a lot about the fact that we should show some empathy for the Confederate soldier, you know, and I think the old story of Johnny Reb, and it's very very somewhat. Heartening to look at that, but at the same time, the goal of the Confederate soldier was to destroy the United States of America. Plain and simple, the reason why they were doing that was to defend slavery and preserve their so-called way of life.
Yeah.
Why should we show empathy to people who were trying to destroy the United States?
Larry, go ahead.
Well, number one reason is that, I guess I would say, is that without forgiveness, we can't heal. And we have to start at a point that says where the country admits that slavery was the cause of the war. I believe that is what is necessary. I agree with that 100%, that slavery was, in fact, the cause of the war. Whether everybody fought in order to either defend or get rid of slavery is a whole nother question. So I think once that is done, it then becomes possible to move forward and to realize that everybody, this was a tragedy that affected the entire country. It affected slaves. It affected people in the North, it affected people in the South. Even Abraham Lincoln in his second address, inaugural address, refers to American slavery. He doesn't refer to Southern slavery. He basically says that the North has a little bit of a responsibility to bear in that regard. But to me, the way to move forward on racial issues is to first understand, again, that slavery was the cause of the war, and then we can begin to parse that out and to begin to forgive ourselves for this horrible institution that affected our history and continues to affect us on a daily basis here in the United States. That's why I believe that at some point they need to be, they at least need to be, recognized. If forgiven is too strong a word, that might be the case, but these were just a bunch of country folk whose mothers felt the pain of their death, as did everybody else.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here. Larry Desautels, author of The Captured, the Sick, and the Dead, Confederate Soldiers at Camp Randall, as we take a look at a piece of Civil War history tied to Camp Randall. You can join in with your reflections, your questions, 800-642-1234. Ed is now with us from Heartland. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Desautels. This is Ed Nelson.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing fine. And by the way, I'm still at Arrowhead. Anyway, my question goes to the section of your book, and hopefully this is not redundant. I just caught what you were saying about the effects of slavery ongoing. The front section and the middle section of the book, you were very explicit about the numbers. What I mean by numbers is those that served in the various Confederate regiments and those that owned slaves and those that didn't. my curiosity is why you think a lot of these young men that had no economic interest, what I mean by that, did not own slaves, still held to the Confederate cause and supported most of their commanders who had, in some cases, a substantial number of slaves.
And Larry, break down first how many of these soldiers owned slaves or had a direct connection to slavery.
Well, I have it by regiments. In the first Alabama, the way I use the expression connected to slavery, that was people who either owned slaves themselves, whose families did, and they were the sons of those families, or who worked for someone who owned slaves. In the first Alabama, it was 30%. And in the first Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi, it was 10%. Among the people who are buried at Camp Randall, at the Forest Hill there, Confederate Rest, it would be 18%. That's how that was the methodology I used. If I couldn't find someone in the census, I assumed they didn't own slaves. So that is the lowest. That is the floor of what the impact of slavery was in those two regiments. So some people would say that's high. Other people would say that's proof that it didn't have much to do with it. To me, if there are 30% of a regiment that is connected to slavery, I would call that important. I would call that something to be taken into consideration. Now, the reason if you didn't own slaves is to understand that slavery was more than just simply an economic system. It was also a cultural system. It provided, it was supported by religion. It was supported by culture. It was, because I am white, I am in a better position than a slave is. The religion said that, that basically slavery was ordained by God, and that the fact that they didn't, that God, Jesus, never actually said there was something wrong with it. It could not be a moral evil.
So what were you able to determine about the soldiers' motivation for fighting in the war for those soldiers who didn't have connections to slavery?
I guess I would say you would have to infer it from others. What I was trying to do was to take a cultural broad look at what was going on in the South. They, if you want to say that that they fought for states' rights, perhaps states' rights over what though? It wasn't like all of a sudden slavery went away as an issue in America when the war started. Now it was just simply about states' rights. It's because it was states' rights about slavery. That's how it comes. That's in a sense how it is. I came up with a system to try to figure it out. I would assume if you are a 19-year-old son of a slave owner and you own slaves in the family, that you're going to be concerned about the future of slavery. So I'm saying those are the ones that we can say for sure had a connection to slavery. Other people, it was part of the culture. The first caller referred to, the Southern way of life. Well, that was part of the Southern way of life.
Let's bring in another call now. Tina is with us from Madison. Hi, Tina.
Hi, thanks for the show. I had a question that went back to an earlier comment that the guest made, which I agree with, about empathy because I think I would have empathy for all soldiers who are usually caught up in ridiculous fights that are crazy. But my question is, or comment, how does the guest see the link to today where you have a lot of white young men, white people in general, still holding on to this idea of this mythological lost cause? How does that mythology of the Confederacy still affect us today? And I will hang up. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. What is that legacy like of the Confederacy? And what have you found in your research, Larry?
Well, the view is that slavery had little to do with the Civil War, which if you read my book, you'll find that I basically reject that assumption. It is a way to defend an action, I believe, of secession and the war that isn't based on something that is so against the American creed as slavery was. Slavery was a tremendously important factor in our early history. It was, in many ways, many people have called it our original sin. So people want to hang on to something for which they can justify something that was wrong. So that is to transfer the cause of the war from slavery to other factors, which are saving their way of life, which is saving their economic standing. It is also true that there were, New York City actually took a vote early in the war to secede from New York because of the impact that the war would have on their economic situation, because that was a big center for the trade of cotton.
I'm going to pause here with Larry Desautels. His book is The Captured, the Sick, and the Dead. He tries to put a face to the Confederate prisoners held at Camp Randall. With your questions, your connections, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on a piece of U.S. Civil War history and the Confederate soldiers held at Camp Randall. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Author Larry Desautels writes, Camp Randall was full of men whose spirit, toughness, and resiliency allowed them to survive their long ordeal at Island Number 10 and in prison. But it was also populated by men demoralized by typhoid, jaundice, measles, and pneumonia. Did your ancestor train at Camp Randall? Do you have ancestors who supported the Confederacy or owned slaves? How do you come to terms with that? It's 800-642-1234. Larry Desautels' book is The Captured, the Sick, and the Dead, and he's with us for the hour. Larry, when you've looked at how Madison responded to the Confederate soldiers who were brought to the city, what did you find?
Well, one thing was that in the election of 1860, when, just as an introduction, when President Lincoln won the vote in the state of Wisconsin, Madison did not support him. Only one ward of the four at the time actually voted majority for Lincoln. So one might have suspected that they would have also been opposed to the war and then the effect of the war, which was to bring these prisoners there. But what they did was they basically felt a human empathy for these guys. They treated them well. They gave them, they bought them tobacco, writing, paper to write on, pens and pencils. They bought them warm clothes. They treated them relatively well. And that was something I think that there was a lot of concern about. What was going to be, was there going to be a negative reaction? But there really wasn't against these prisoners, because I think a lot of people saw in them their own children, their own relatives who might be in a similar situation somewhere else in the war. So I think they treated them very well and tried to do what was right by them. But as it turned out, the disease that was going through the camp overcame all of that.
Yeah, I mean, some of these soldiers arrived very ill. Some arrived on stretchers. How did they die? What was happening?
Well, they died of typhoid. They died of cholera. They died of yellow fever, or the janders, as it was called at the time. They died of tuberculosis. They died of diseases that there was basically no treatment for, and particularly in a situation that had been caused because, these guys were standing in the flooded Mississippi for weeks trying to defend their position. And, they came sick and they got sicker, and 140 of them died. Some of them died on the day they got there. That is on April 20th of 1862. Some died on the way. A whole bunch of them were brought up the Mississippi River up to Prairie du Chien and then to Madison. And many of them died on that route. Those guys were were sent that way because they thought they were too sick to travel by rail. So they actually got to Madison a few days later on the 24th of April of 1862. And many of them were suffering.
You write about a guard, a Union guard, Clarence Wicks, who shot and killed one of the Confederate soldiers. What happened?
Well, yeah, Clarence Wicks was 16 years old. He was Company K of the 19th Regiment. Well, it's kind of a long story, but as it turns out, Henry, there was a soldier from the first Consolidated, the first Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi, named Henry Spears, who had two brothers there. One of the brothers, Alexander, died a few days earlier of disease, and Spears himself was suffering, and he went out to relieve himself, they were supposed to go to designated sinks, as they were called, but he just kind of squatted down relatively close to this guard, Clarence Wicks, and so Wicks told him he had to get out of there. The guy refused. Wicks threw a stone and hit him in the head with it. And at that point, Henry Spears's brother, George, came out of his barracks with a few other prisoners and went after Clarence Wicks. That is, they approached him and started swearing at him. And Wicks claimed later that he had orders to shoot prisoners that were abusive towards him. So he shot and killed George Washington Spears, who died. That was on the 16th of April of 1862. And then they had a court of inquiry in which Spears was said to have acted inappropriately and that Wicks was justified in his shooting.
As the weeks wore on at Camp Randall, did you learn how at all attitudes toward the prisoners shifted or changed, or did they remain the same in Wisconsin?
Well, the one of the things that happened was that the access to the by the public to the camp ended. They finally decided that because they were afraid that that in the back and forth that prisoners would be able to escape with people coming in to give them food or whatever the case might be. So they closed it off. And as time went on, you know, think of it as the prisoners were there longer and the 19th Wisconsin became more and more disillusioned with being, you know, guards instead of being out there in the battlefield earning glory. The relations between the two kept getting worse and worse. In fact, maybe it's said that part of what Henry Spears did was part of a campaign that they would try to intimidate the guards by coming out and relieving themselves right in front of them, of throwing things at them and then making fun of them. So things got worse and worse. It culminated with the shooting death of George Washington Spears, who was only 21 years old at the time. You know, it happened to be kind of the thing that was almost considered to be the final straw. And it was only a couple of weeks later that the camp was closed.
We're talking with Larry Desautels, author of The Captured, The Sick, and the Dead, Confederate Soldiers at Camp Randall, as we look at this piece of Civil War history. With your insights, do you have ancestors who served in the Civil War? How have you come to terms with what they supported or what they did? Join in at 800-642-1234. Larry, why did the government ultimately shut down Camp Randall as a detention facility?
Well, the official reason was that, William Hoffman gave it, was that the death rate was too high. The death rate approached about a little bit over two people per day were dying at Camp Randall. And I think that Hoffman had a little bit of a bias against Camp Randall because he didn't want it to be there in the first place as a facility for prisoners. And so he kind of decided that he was going to look for reasons to close it down. He didn't think that they had done a good job with this court of inquiry. He believed that that the regimen had taken supplies and used it for their own benefit, you know, wood to build barracks and beds, and that they took bedding from the prisoners. These were all reports that he was getting. He came to visit it prior to closing it down, and he basically wrote a report that said there was no convalescence going on anywhere in the camp. And so by the end of May, he said, it's got to be closed. And the prisoners were sent to back, all of them were sent back to Camp Douglas in Chicago. You know, one of the things that Hoffman really centered on was that there were 167 bottles of whiskey that were supposed to be used for the claimed medicinal purposes that were all drunk by members of the 19th Wisconsin.
There were also women, non-combatants, who were captured and brought to Wisconsin. What was their role in the war?
Well, some of the women, there was one who, Bridget Higgins, who's came to Island Number 10 with her husband and children, and he died, as did the two children. He had a brother who was in the First Alabama, who also who survived, and she came to Camp Randall with him, and she got real sick, almost died. But she was one example of a woman. There were a few women that were there, and she was the one that was the most notable one of that group. There was also, interestingly, probably a slave there.
And this slave who was captured with the Confederate soldiers, what do you know about him?
Well, I know that he was from Choctaw County, Alabama. He was owned by a guy by the name of Charles Zell, whose mother owned about three or four slaves, and Charles owned about that same number. The slave's name was John Wesley, and that he was probably about 16 years old at the time when he was brought up to Madison. Unfortunately, there's no record of what happened to him. By this time, there was the contraband policy in effect, so he may have just simply been allowed to leave.
Yeah, but you're not sure.
But it worked.
What happened? There's no official record. Talking with historian Larry Desautel, his debut book explores the lives of the Confederate soldiers who were imprisoned in Wisconsin during the Civil War. Confederate Rest, the site of 140 Confederate graves in Madison, was one of the earliest acts of reconciliation between the North and the South on Memorial Day 1872. So what does reconciliation look like today? What should be done with Confederate memorials? How do you view systemic racism through the lens of Civil War battles? Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Larry Desautel on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with author and historian Larry Desautel. He started researching and writing his book on Confederate soldiers after visiting Forest Hill Cemetery in Madison. He came across the 140 graves in the section called Confederate Rest. They were soldiers who died in captivity at Camp Randall, and he wanted to shine a light on their stories. Larry, in 2017, you were at Confederate Rest for Memorial Day as part of the research for your book, and you described the ceremonies as a day of contrasts. What did you observe?
Well, there were two ceremonies, and these have been going on since 1872. There was a ceremony where some of the Union soldiers are buried, and that was very nice. They had a young woman, I remember she was from Broadhead, who sang beautifully, you know, and really moved the crowd. And they gave speeches about the capture of Jefferson Davis because it was a Wisconsin cavalry unit that did so. And that was very nice. And then they played, you know, Taps, and like, there, you know, there are a lot of misty eyes as a result of that. Then we went over to, you know, just a little bit over to the where Confederate Rest is and where the soldiers are buried. And one of the things that had happened that day was that the city had decided they were going to take the flagpole down so that no flags could be flown, which had been policy since since in the 1970s to allow the flying of the battle flag of the Army of Northern Virginia. So they were all a little bit out of sorts, were the people who supported it. And a guy gives a speech. It was kind of rambling. And he tried to say that the Civil War was not about slavery, because none of these people, he was referring to those who are buried there, none of these people had any connection to slavery. And, you know, I had found that was just patently not true. 18% of them had some connection to slavery, and a strong connection. And he gave a speech, which was, again, very rambling and very confusing, and really no mention of them, no human element, which is what I was trying to get at. And if I may, realize Wisconsin was the first state that actually began to recognize Confederate prisoners. That was the governor back in 1872, a guy by the name of Cadwallader Washburn, who had been a Union general, head of the 19th Cavalry Corps. And he said, we should honor these people. They fought for a horrible cause, but we need to reconcile.
I want to look for a moment at the United Daughters of the Confederacy, this group, and the role of Alice Whiting of Baton Rouge, who first visited Confederate Rest in 1868. She didn't like what she saw, and she decided she would improve its appearance. What did she do?
Well, when the soldiers first got buried, there was a company called that basically created a marker for them, and it had their name, their regiment, and so on. Well, what she found was that all of these were in a terrible, state of disrepair. So she basically, what she did at least three times during her lifetime is she replaced those markers with new ones. And then when the second generation began to fade because of weathering and so on, she had another one done. And then because she thought that this was important, she was a Southern girl. She thought that these, you know, like most people, when they go to a cemetery, they want to see it well kept to preserve the memory, even if they don't know the people that are there. She took that over, and she did a great job, because what it did is it really helped preserve the names of the people that were there. So I think she played a tremendously important role.
And, you know, while these monuments, a monument like this may be understood as part of the legacy of Confederate veterans, as you say, understanding their story, it also may be viewed as affirming an ideology that supports racial oppression. Is it possible for monuments in public spaces to reflect the shared values of a full community?
I think it's difficult, because I think what any monument says, it says more about the people or the who put it up or the times in which it was placed than it does about the situation that it is commemorating. When the United Daughters of the Confederacy marker got put up, the one that's been since removed, it was fully supported by by Union veterans. They supported it. There was a guy named Frank Oakley who actually encouraged this to be done, to raise money from Alabama to build this. The Grand Army of the Republic was there as part of the ceremonies in 1906. The one thing they did do, though, or maybe perhaps best to say they didn't do, is they would not allow the flying of the Confederate flag. Now, to me, if the generation who fought the war, guys who were standing there without an arm or without a leg, thought it was okay to do this, to somehow not encourage, but to somehow at least recognize their, you know, fallen soldiers, you know, a soldier's tribute to fellow soldiers, then we can do the same thing today. I mean, to me, they're the ones who kind of should set the policy. But again, I think today that the argument today is over politics of today much more than it is about the situation of the Civil War. Again, when they gave the speeches, they said there's no way you can condone what the Confederacy did. And I agree. There's no way you can condone it. All you can say is you were wrong, but we're going to have to forgive you, because without forgiveness, we can't move forward.
We're talking with Larry Desautel, author of The Captured, The Sick, and the Dead. Let's take another call now. Margo is with us from Brookfield. Hi, Margo.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I have been to Confederate Rest, and if any of the other listeners have not, I would, very, very interesting spot. And I've read Larry's book. It's also intriguing. It helped me tremendously to understand some of the components of the Civil War that I thought my own education had glossed over. What I'm wondering about and have been catapulted to is that looking at an ancestor who was in the Civil War, and wondering if Larry has some ideas on where I might begin that research. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Margo, thank you. Where should Margo begin researching?
Well, I started with the Wisconsin Historical Society. There's something called if the person is from Wisconsin, the roster of Wisconsin volunteers. You can get that online through the Wisconsin Historical Society. And then if he's not from Wisconsin, then you're going to have to go to the Historical Society of that particular state. And you can also go to, the Ancestry.com. That's where I found a lot of information about the soldiers that were in the regiments that were brought to Camp Randall. But again, I don't know whether the relative here is from Wisconsin, but Wisconsin has a lot of great resources through the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Last year, the Confederate Rest Monument to the dead Confederate soldiers, that was removed from Forest Hill Cemetery, as you mentioned. The pain and suffering lives on, the caused, by slavery. What should we do as a country to come to terms with this?
Well, I look at it perhaps differently, because I don't believe that taking out the monument does anything to take away the pain and suffering that the Civil War caused. To me, it, and again, this is my personal view, is that keep the monuments there, but then interpret them. Say the United Daughters of the Confederacy has attempted to mythologize the war as a lost cause, as not about slavery, but to do away with every monument like that, because basically the monument had the names of the soldiers on it. It wasn't necessarily, talking about how great Robert E. Lee was or Nathan Bedford Forrest or anybody like that. It was just the name of those soldiers, a bunch of, basically farmers from Alabama and states like that. So that's my view. I don't think you can get rid of history that you don't like.
Larry, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on, and I hope that that people could read the book and get it at sandbeachpress.com.
Larry Desautel, author of The Captured, The Sick, and the Dead. He taught history and political science at Arrowhead High School in Heartland. Just ahead, it is 1A. We're living longer than ever. 1A talks with two centenarians about the potential for an extended life. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.